The Cyberspace Report with your hosts, Lisa Covey and Jim Whitehead. Only on KUCI Irvine. Okay, welcome Cybernauts to another edition of the Cyberspace Report. My name is Jim Whitehead, and I am your host for this show. I guess we also have in the studio with us today our oftentimes guest, Becky Grinter, and another guest who's been on the show before, Professor Mark Ackerman. So anyway, we have a very special guest with us here today. His name is Ted Nelson, and among his achievements in his life, he has invented hypertext, and he's been a he's been working on a system called the Xanadu system for a number of years. So anyway, why don't you say hi to the gathered fans, Mr. Nelson?
Oh, howdy all you out there in Radio Land. A number of years comes to 35 right now.
Okay, well, I didn't want to mention that in case you want to sort of preserve that fact, but. So let's get right into the hypertext, and what inspiration led you to develop hypertext?
I was always as a kid into writing and reading and literature and movies, basically, and like a whole lot of people, and I'd done a great deal of writing as a youth, and a rewrite, and the intricacy of taking ideas and sentences and trying to make them into coherent, presentable structures of thought struck me as an extremely intricate and complex task, and I particularly minded having to take thoughts which were not intrinsically sequential and somehow put them in a row, because print as it appears on the paper or handwriting is sequential. Now, there was always something wrong with that, because you were trying to take these thoughts which had a structure, shall we say, a spatial structure all their own, and put them into linear form. Now, then the reader had to take this linear structure and recompose his or her picture of the overall content, once again placed in this non-sequential structure. So you had two, it seemed, and now I'm reconstructing because I hadn't thought this out, I don't know how explicitly I thought this out as a youth, but you had to take these two additional steps of deconstructing some thoughts into linear sequence and then reconstructing them. Why couldn't all that all be bypassed by having a non-sequential structure of thought which you presented directly? And that was the hypothesis, well, the hypothesis, really, of hypertext, that you could save both the writer's time and the reader's time and effort in putting together and understanding what was being presented.
Thanks. Hi, this is Becky Grinter.
Hello.
I'd like to ask you, what was your inspiration for the Xanadu system itself?
Well, basically, Xanadu has always been coextensive with my whole paradigm. I gave a talk on this last night at Xerox PARC, which was that, A, you want to be able to keep track of your own creative output, being able to see the differences between my own versions and say, gee, if I move this from the beginning to the middle, and let's try it that way, but then let's try moving the middle to the beginning in another version, how does it come out each way? So on the one hand, you want, as a writer or creative constructor of anything, those tools which will most contribute to your understanding of the consequences of your own design decisions. On the other hand, for a new publishing system of the future, and it seemed manifest to me in 1960 that we would be reading and writing on computer screens that were interactive, and all this would be fed by a vast feeder network of digitalia around the world. Since we're going to be publishing in a system of this kind, what would be the reward structure, what would be the document structure, and what would be the most beneficial extension of literature as we knew it? And to me, literature is the great ideal here, not some engineer's notion of information retrieval. The engineers seem to have the notion that you can take the documents that are written and dip them in some sort of technical acid, and the facts will fall to the bottom, and then these facts will roll into their appropriate slots. This is not so. Writing is the way it is. Every word generally has some kind of meaning. And it's finding these meanings and making them most useful to me that seems the great problem. So the issue is, what will be the extension of literature into the great realm of interactive, multidimensional, many-threaded presentational forms? So Xanadu basically has been my name for an evolving but essentially centrally the same system for the supply and presentation of material, with two basic relationships, what we would call a link, which is a connection, an unchanging connection between objects or parts which are different, and a transclusion, which is a maintained connection between parts which are the same. And this is the part that no one understands yet. I have all these young twerps or excuse me, thoughtful people come up to me and say, well, Ted, how does it feel now that everything you've done is here? And I say, I clap my hand on my forehead and say, no, 1,000 times no, because you don't get it yet. Mm-hmm. To me, the central aspect of transclusion is not yet a part of this. Transclusion means, A, being able to use the same thing in many places, and B, being able to look at this same thing in its several contexts side by side, so that if you've quoted something, you can see its original context. And creating a universal publishing method with automatic royalty, and this has everyone confused, but if you take it slowly, it's very straightforward, with automatic royalty, so that everything published under this method becomes clip art and boilerplate. You can recomposite all the stuff that's already in Xanadu, see its previous context, and reuse the materials freely. It seems a very straightforward and very noble goal even today, and even with all the insults I daily have to endure.
So now this transclusion is very important to your vision, but also what's very important is the notion that you get some market economics into it. How exactly did you intend to charge people? You know, how did you intend for the charging of information to work in the Xanadu system?
Well, interestingly, this was in the design from the very first, but being a monist, I had a lot of trouble teasing out the separate parts, because it all... It's as though you've had a vision of something very simple, like a spiral or an octopus, but you can't quite communicate it to people. And so I would always, you know, to me it was always, you fools, don't you get it? And now as I approach the age of 60, I'm a little more mellow and realize that people have their own points of view, and also that it's possible to be right and uncomprehended for a very long period of time. So and the thing is that since about three quarters of what I expected has come true, and except for the central part, I have this sublime, blissful, and very annoyed confidence that it's all going to come out just as I said. Okay, so the charging mechanism is very straightforward. And again, this is the essence of what I thought of in 1960. It is now, with a great deal of legal research and specificity, it's now tuned up to an appropriate way for the present. The idea is that materials are owned. When I say materials, I mean video frames, bytes of text, etc. And anyone who chooses to use this publishing system may place the material in what we'll call a quotable repository. Now, the quotable repository means it's now there, its address is available, and it's going to stay there. So as the publisher, A, you're promising that you own the rights, B, you're taking legal responsibility for the contents, C, you're guaranteeing that it's going to stay there unchanged. The change mechanisms have to take into account the fact that the previous versions, once published, have to be available in that same form for the people who are using them in that earlier form. Okay, so the quotable repository will then sell portions of the material to all comers. So let's say you set your royalty rate at, let's say, 4,000 nanobucks per byte. Now, to me, the nanobuck appears to be the appropriate order of magnitude for the currency, nanobuck being 1/1,000,000,000 of a cent. Now, that seems absurdly low, but let's think about it a second. If you divide it up, my thumbnail calculations indicate that the average royalty on a novel is about 4,000 nanobucks per byte. So if you're getting a 100,000-word novel, like a love story, you're getting 100,000 times the original author is getting from the publisher about 100,000 times 4,000 nanobucks, or something like a couple bucks a book. So that seems about the right range, and I believe that the profit margin on a store-bought and videotape is something on the order of 18,000 nanobucks per frame. So that while this seems like a crazy unit, if you either inflate it or deflate it by a couple of orders of magnitude, you've still got something to work with. So it seems to be in the right range of the price. Okay, so now we're saying that this is a full sale, meaning that the recipient has bought a copy. What the recipient does with it, save it or throw it away, is their business. But remember, they're not paying very much for it, so it's disposable. It's like a chewing gum wrapper. You can save it and put it in an album or not. And my expectation is that many, many people will be filling lots and lots of oxide with the materials they save, because just as you, as your personality and your life are very much represented by the books you own and the videotapes on your shelf, so you'll be saving the materials you like. So you buy a piece. I'm just talking now about the mechanics of purchase of an individual fragment. There's a certain paragraph you're going to get, and so you have its address, and you your machine automatically sends for it from a quotable repository and pays two kinds of money. The royalty, which is remanded directly to the publisher at, let's say, 4,000 nanobucks per byte, and a service charge to the repository. Now, these might be bundled together in some way. I'm just saying that logically they contain these two elements. And people are free to do it any way they like. I'm just outlining one particular method. So the purchaser now owns a legitimate copy, a legitimate purchased copy for all time, in principle, of these bytes, which may be saved. You may print out one copy, at least according to my standard contract, but other people are free to set other deals. You now own those bytes, and that's part of your library, and you have a receipt to prove it, and you have a little identification tag with that chunk of bytes, which identifies it as you flip through your library. This identification tag you can put in any sort of database or handle in any way you'd like that stays associated with these bytes if you keep them. And the identification tag probably will be the actual receipt which shows that you purchased the bytes. So that's how one small transaction occurs. Now, how do we make that into a boilerplate world of which I've spoken? In other words, I'm proposing that you be able to publish a document containing all of your favorite things. Let's say you want to do a study of something or other. You want to take the Mona Lisa and superimpose it and show how it. A friend of mine superimposed the Mona Lisa with Leonardo's face and claimed that it was the same that he was actually painting himself. So I'd say you want to superimpose it with Alfred E. Newman and point out this and that and have some quotations from modern poets and some recent music out of the garage bands of Orange County. Okay, so you're creating this composition, and what of it have you yourself created? Well, you've written a few introductory paragraphs, and you have a picture of yourself. Okay, so you place on the system what you publish is logically the following: it is a map of the proposed object, saying, in order to put together my composition, which I'll call Alfred Mona, you're going to have to buy this picture of the Mona Lisa from the website of the Louvre, this picture of Alfred E. Newman from Mad Magazine's website, this stuff from the garage bands of Southern California, and it's to be composited in the following way. You're going to paste this part on here, this is next to that, and you're going to interact with it in such and such a way. So you've published essentially a map of the pieces, and your personal machine, your server, which is doing essentially what Mosaic does, because of course Mosaic was based, as far as I know, on the Xanadu designs. It's much simpler, but it's a fine production, Mosaic and Netscape. So your Mosaic or your Netscape program goes out, respectively calls up these various sources, respectively carries out the transactions, and now into your system and onto your disks pour the respective components of this proposed construction. So in order to get Mona Newman, your machine has gone and bought these different parts and composited, and there it is on your screen. So QED, you have been able to use everything that was already there as boilerplate. You've been able to make your arbitrary construct, and you got the royalty on the bytes which you created, but everything else was available to you as scenery, as clip art, in the overall construction you were creating. And by the way, since all the addresses of the previous material are together with your receipt, if you say, gee, I'd like to see more of that, you can go back to Mad Magazine's site, or you can go back to the Leonardo site, or whatever, or the Garage Bands, and get more stuff from them. So it's essentially got outreach to these other sources. Now, there's one other component I haven't mentioned. People say, what about copyright law? And that's the beauty part, because in fact, copyright, this works perfectly well within the copyright law under a very simple proposed extension, which is not an extension to the law. It is a permission doctrine. Permission doctrine means, well, if, for example, you write at the top of a published article, all federal government agencies may use this freely, or if you write, Episcopalians are free to reproduce this, or anything of that kind, you have essentially created a permission structure on that document. It relies on your copyright, meaning that it implicitly relies on your copyright to say that other permissions are not granted. But with this permission, you have essentially granted certain licenses to certain classes of user. Bob Wallace, my friend who created the term shareware, did a very good service to the people by creating this term, because now that you can say, this is shareware, you can hand somebody a disk and say, this is shareware, and they understand that that means they can share its contents. They may owe some money to him or something, or according to whatever he wants to do, and there's a problem collecting, but at the same time, everyone understands that the shareware concept means you're free to share. So I'm proposing a permission doctrine like shareware. Shareware, once again, is a permission doctrine saying you're free to share this material, specifics to be found inside. So the permission doctrine I am proposing, or rather have declared and defined, I call trans-copyright. Now, trans-copyright is a permission doctrine, which means I hereby claim the right to this material, I hereby promise to keep it available, and I grant all parties the right to reuse it virtually as clip art if what they do is publish pointers to it, allowing others to composite their virtual structures, obtaining it from me or my agents. So in other words, the permission is to you to reuse this in any way as long as you get it from me in principle, and in return, I relinquish all context control. And that's the kicker, because it won't work unless the rights holder relinquishes the context control. So yes, it could turn up in pornography. Yes, it can turn up in political tracts, and that's what it means to be freely reusable. And I think as a practical matter, that's not going to be a big deal.
So it sounds to me like the Xanadu system, many, many years ago, solved a lot of the really pertinent problems that are just only starting to surface in the World Wide Web today. But yet the World Wide Web has managed to become sort of by now the dominant hypertext paradigm for the vast majority of people in the United States. Right now, when you say hypertext, they think of Netscape or Mosaic, and that is their notion of hypertext. So now that the World Wide Web is so dominant, how does Xanadu have to change to modify itself to sort of fit into the new reality of a World Wide Web world?
Well, that's a good question. I'm still muddling with it. First of all, I think the World Wide Web was a brilliant simplification. As I understand it, and maybe I have this wrong, but Tim Berners-Lee came and we had lunch in, I guess it was 1989, 90, something like that, in Sausalito, and really liked the guy, and he'd done this very simple thing, and it sounded too trivial to me. but he certainly was a nice fellow, and I expected to keep in touch with him. Well, I'm a very bad correspondent, and the next thing I knew, suddenly the thing had caught on. And what it turns out to be is simply an extension of file transfer protocol. In other words, it's saying, you can anonymously go and dip in and take out this file, and here's a proposed way to look at it. And this is called HTML. You have to understand the HTML, SGML kind of format where you've got all these warty little knobs and boogers in it that are formatting codes. This is absolutely contrary to the Xanadu idea that you have clean data undefiled. However, it works. It's very simple, and you can always take those things out. So that's okay. But all it is FTP with lipstick, so that you can look at these things and the jump addresses are hidden and the formats and you have paragraph levels and stuff, and it's basically what people need. Frankly, I think it's much better than word processing. I mean, I'm really happy now that I'm planning now to switch from Microsoft Word to HTML, just because there's no need not to, and it's a perfectly good format, and it makes everything simpler to browse it. And writing in Microsoft Word format is even worse, so what the hell. But the question, what you've asked is how to relate Xanadu. Well, all we need to add to this is the transaction method that allows the pieces to be bought. Right now, many people are thinking of the web as free, except for those people who are rubbing their hands and saying, oh, I'm going to charge $10 a page. And both of those are idealistic extremities. Everything will not be free, and $10 a page is ridiculous. The whole point is to have the capability for very small transactions and a clean system for the sale of materials that opens things up. As I've said, everyone else is planning on a continuation of the closed media model, where you sell a videotape or a record and it's finished. You can't change it. And that's what I am implicitly trying to undercut. I'm saying that everything has to become boilerplate now.
Now, again,
it doesn't have to. I'm just inviting people to join me in this crusade, because you lose nothing and you gain the world.
I have a question for you. You've obviously been at one point a visionary, because
at one point, well,
at one point,
when did that end?
Even now, I guess, just now, you know, with the World Wide Web and so forth, your ideas are taking on a sort of a new reality in some way, shape, and form,
or seemingly more real to some people.
Yeah, I'd like to ask you, you know, what's been your experience of if people that seem like visionary ideas right now, how would you encourage them to go about turning them into reality based on your own experiences?
Wait, what would I recommend to a young visionary today?
Yeah.
Very straightforward. Learn to deal with short-term goals and not delegate. I trusted them. The famous last words. And these are people I still love and respect. But if I had been able to hold it together and not try to overstretch and overgrab, and managed short-term goals better, things would have been very different. But again, I took a big goal as a single unit, and then I turned it over to others who took it as a single unit and made it a bigger goal, and thus postponed dealing with a well-defined situation.
Okay, well, certainly the Xanadu system has had sort of a checkered, and some would say tragic history.
The past tense I don't agree with, and we're having a meeting right now as to how best to put the system on the web, because it's still working better than it was in 1992, and as far as I know, it can be finished.
Excellent. So,
but by the way, the term Xanadu is now my trademark. So that the fine-grained server, which was developed at Autodesk, is what we're referring to here. But I'm putting together specs for general analogical products that essentially meet the things I want, and licensing people to use that trade name for products that appear to meet those specs.
Excellent. Now, I guess there was a recent article in Wired magazine which took a very critical view of the whole Xanadu project to date. I know that I've received some email from you where you were saying that you thought that the article was almost libelous.
Definitely
libelous. Would you care to comment about sort of your objections to the Wired article, which many of our listeners probably have access to?
Sure. Well, it comes down to a great deal to personal viewpoint and personal integrity. People see the world differently, and the reporter, whose name is Gary Wolf, makes his biases extremely clear in the article, but they were by no means clear when he so charmingly inveigled his way into my confidence. Now, of course, I've generally taken the point of view that posterity would like what I did, and so I've trusted journalists as sort of ambassadors from posterity, and this has been a mistake in general. But Mr. Wolf did not make his biases in any way evident when we saw each other. It turns out that the three things he most dislikes, as far as I can tell, are idealism, untidiness, and immodesty. All three of which he found in profusion in the Xanadu project. For myself, I have always hated things and people, people who were regarded as shallow, conventional, pompous, and smug. So each of us hit the jackpot in the other. And but as I say, he got to strike first in this extremely scurrilous and nasty piece. He emailed me recently saying, "Gee, I seem to have overlooked all the positive statements," which is interesting because in my 8 or so readings of the article, I did not find one positive statement which was not immediately taken back by sarcasm or innuendo. What I object to is particularly as actually libelous in the piece, of course, has nothing to do. Well, of course, it has something to do, but is not directly a matter of its tone or its nastiness. Libel consists of damaging false statements which are being promulgated either maliciously or negligently. Now, as a reporter, your standards for negligence may be rather slippery, but this man had definite access to a great deal of information, and I believe he was extremely, shall we say, disingenuous in the use of that information and how he passed it on. For example, he very amusingly talks about us as if we are blundering hobbyists, and says what computer scientists would not have agreed with this. Therefore, according to Wolf, we were not computer scientists, right? He says of Roger Gregory, my good friend, whom he impugned and was much nastier to than me, he says, Roger Gregory was not an elite researcher or computer scientist. Yet a few paragraphs later, he mentions that Roger developed a new addressing scheme based on transfinite arithmetic. Now, I do not know what Mr. Wolf means by computer science, but within my world, someone who invents an addressing scheme based on transfinite arithmetic is not stamp collecting. That's computer science, or it was that week. And this is serious stuff. And by elite researcher, I suppose he means anointed researchers, such as having PhDs or working at Xerox PARC or being licensed to kiss the feet of so-and-so. But we basically, on our own, we're doing important, strong work at the forefront, and Mr. Wolf has made a point of trashing us and ignoring any indication that we were not a bunch of deranged hobbyists. For example, he does not mention the contributions of Eric Drexler to the team, precisely, I think, because everyone agrees that Eric Drexler is a scientist, and therefore obviously doesn't fit into Mr. Wolf's thesis.
Yeah, it almost seems like there's been a backlash against you as a hypertext visionary. Do you think that's true?
There's no question. I don't understand these things because, you know, my self-image is one of endurance against a thousand obstacles, and other people set out in great measure, to ridicule and slander me, and I don't get it. There's some status stuff going on, and also there's some paradigm stuff going on. In other words, from the point of view of what we may call the hypertext community now, I'm some kind of a has-been because they don't get that what they're doing is the cutting edge. And from my point of view, they don't get that what I'm doing is still the cutting edge and that they only understand a part of it because they don't get transclusion, which to me is the center of everything.
All right, well, you're listening to KUCI 88.9 FM in Irvine, and we've been talking for the past half hour to Ted Nelson, the inventor of hypertext, among other things. We're just about out of time. Do you have any final last words for our audience?
No, but just thank you very much for listening, Orange County, and I'm with you in spirit, and good luck with the bonds.
All right, and good luck with your future endeavors as well with the Xanadu system.
Thanks. Enjoy talking to you.
Okay.
All right,
bye-bye. Okay, so this has been the Cyberspace Report. Our time changes next week. The Cyberspace Report will be broadcasting next week from 5 until 5:30 on Thursday. So make sure to join us again next week on the Cyberspace Report. You never know who will actually be on the Cyberspace Report from week to week. So anyway, my name is Jim Whitehead. I've been your host for this program, although I didn't get to say much. My email is ejw@ics.uci.edu, and I welcome your comments. Thanks for listening.